Welcome to Trade-Off, a marketplace special about the globalization backlash. How'd we get here, and what happens next? I'm Scott Tong, correspondent for Marketplace's Sustainability Desk, joined by...
Sarah Gardner, fellow Marketplace reporter. Hi, everybody.
For the last few months, we've been reporting on the discontent with open trade and open borders voiced in American politics. Now, to critics, other countries are getting a better deal, to use a word near and dear to our president, who is pushing to limit immigration and trade deals. To be sure, this chorus to raise the drawbridge has been building for years, but now it's starting to matter. The obvious case in point is the election.
Build a wall! Build a wall!
And the U.S. isn't the only place with those rumblings. There's Brexit, the U.K.'s vote to leave the European Union, plus more right-wing nationalist candidates, France, the Netherlands.
To me, personally, this is remarkable. It's a little bit jarring. See, I grew up largely overseas, in places that had to connect with the rest of the world. But more to the point, I grew up in the 80s, when the end of the Cold War taught us that open borders and capitalism and free trade, they won.
Right. The end of history, the new world order, right?
I graduated in 1991 from Georgetown, and I went back with a few classmates to ask, what happened? So here's my good friend Cynthia Bertolini, global citizen. She went to Europe after graduation, married a nice Italian man. She's remembering the Berlin Wall falling junior year.
I remember vividly watching the wall come down and thinking about there is no more East Germany, there is no more West Germany, and thinking, what could that mean elsewhere in the world in terms of opening up?
Well, she got her answer. It meant eventually the European Union. Free movement of people, money, goods, the same currency. But politics focuses on the cost, the human costs, of course.
Now, the key to open trade is to find a way to take care of the so-called losers, the casualties of free trade, if you will. Here's political scientist Jennifer Tobin. I spoke to her at Georgetown on my little back-to-school trip.
We know who's going to lose their jobs from this, and so we need to create policies that redistribute towards them, and that didn't occur. And that didn't occur around the world.
And we should point out here, Scott, that outsourcing didn't take away all those jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Robots and automation have done a lot of that, too, especially in recent years. But when the losses sting, and they do, it's easier to blame other countries and people than machines.
So here's my takeaway from going back to school. Free trade and globalization seemed the normal state of things back then and for most of my adult life. But maybe it's not the norm. And perhaps if you step back in time enough, it may actually be the exception. Jamie Martin is an incoming history professor at Georgetown.
Globalization is not inevitable. It won't necessarily proceed smoothly. Globalization, far from being inevitable, could easily go into reverse or even collapse.
And that happened. In the 1930s, at the start of the Depression in Europe, here in the U.S., populism and protectionism and nationalism prevailed. Borders won. Economists lost. World trade collapsed.
And those swings between protectionism and free trade, that's what we're going to look at. We've come to think of free trade as very American, right? Very free market capitalism. But if you go back to the beginning of the U.S. economy, we did not start out that way.
Okay, so how far back are we going?
Well, we're actually going all the way back to this guy.
Don't be shocked when your history book mentions me. I will lay down my life if it sets us free. Eventually, you'll see my ascendancy.
Alexander Hamilton? I'm assuming you're talking about, I don't know, the musical or the guy. You know what? I'll let you take it from here.
Okay, here we go. So protectionism can mean a lot of things. It can be a tax on imports, a ban on immigrants from a certain country, or a rule limiting foreign investment. But it all comes down to gatekeeping.
Mm-hmm.
America has a long history of keeping out imports when it suits us. And that goes as far back as, yes, Hamilton. You might call him our original protectionist.
Uh-huh.
Now, the Broadway musical skipped over that part. So to find that Hamilton, you actually have to go to Jersey. Patterson, New Jersey. Drive through town and you pass bodegas, pawn shops, discount stores, and then you come to something totally unexpected. A national park, complete with a wisecracking park ranger, Smokey Bear hat and all.
My name's Elise, and I'm highly entertaining. So
Elise Goldman is supervisory park ranger at Patterson Great Falls National Historical Park. This is where the Passaic River falls into a stunning 77-foot chasm.
All right, get your cameras ready. It is a beautiful view.
Goldman tells us Alexander Hamilton actually picnicked here with George Washington during the American Revolution. They ate cold ham and tongue. They drank alcohol. And maybe they planted the first seeds of American manufacturing. Now, we don't know what they said exactly, so Goldman invents some lines for Hamilton.
He gets up from the picnic, he goes over to the chasm, he looks at the falls, and he says, wow, you know, water's powerful.
Powerful enough to turn water wheels to run cotton mills. The British had banned the colonies from importing anything that would empower them to build their own factories. So after the U.S. wins its independence, Hamilton, he's now Treasury Secretary, he wants to change that. An aide writes to him suggesting Passaic Falls might be a good place to build textile mills.
He's sitting at a desk. It's late one night. He reads the letter and says, oh my God, I totally remember that place. We had tongue.
So Hamilton gets some investors together, and he makes the intellectual argument for homegrown industries in something called the Report on Manufacturers, a real slog, but important. So we took a cue from Hamilton the musical and translated a key idea from the report into lyrics. Now, stay with me. I'm not going to perform, I promise. We called in a professional, Javon Carter, from the Stooges Brass Band.
All right, man, let me get his head shot.
So you wanna be free? So you wanna be free? So you of British tyranny? Of British tyranny? Then gentlemen build? Then gentlemen build? An American factory? An American factory? We'll tax the goods so high? It'll be foolish to buy? Anything but American? Buy American?
Tax imports by American. You get the idea. That's part of what economists call the infant industries argument for protectionism, helping shield fledgling industries from seasoned foreign competitors so they can get big enough to play with the big kids someday. Hamilton also pushed for government subsidies, money to give homegrown industries a competitive edge. That's another kind of protectionism, but that wasn't as popular back then. Now, Hamilton didn't live to see it. He died in 1804 after dueling with the vice president. But eventually, after several decades, the experiment at Passaic Falls worked. Patterson became a quintessential American factory town.
That small building was the powerhouse to the Ivanhoe paper mill.
Paper and cotton, silk, guns. Patterson and other early American industrial cities succeeded partly because Congress imposed tariffs on foreign goods. In 1816, the U.S. adopted the first tariff specifically to keep out imports, not just feed government coffers. And that launched a long history of American protectionism and a fierce debate over free trade that's still alive today.
I think it's hard for us nowadays to appreciate the extent to which in the 19th century, the tariff was, for many people, a religious conviction.
American historian Eric Rauchway at the University of California, Davis.
Of course, for Republicans and for the majority view in the 19th and early 20th century, to be pro-tariff was to be American.
In fact, some called the GOP the grand old protectionists. Free trade sounded suspiciously unpatriotic. So protectionism, not free trade, was the American way for much of our history. We hear President Trump complain that China unfairly props up its steel industry, dumping cheap steel into global markets. That makes it hard for American steel to compete. People lose their jobs. Well, reality check. We were an emerging protectionist nation once, too. But there's a wrinkle here, and an important one. Some people argue, look, protectionism built America, and we developed into a world power by putting America first.
But what that argument overlooks is the fact that we were completely open to migration. So we had a lot of immigrants.
Dartmouth historian Douglas Irwin says on the whole,
we were completely open to capital flows, and we borrowed a lot of money from British financiers. We were completely open to foreign technology. So we weren't really a closed economy in the 19th century. We were limited trade, but we were open in terms of ideas, capital, the movement of people.
At the end of that tour in Paterson, I ask another tourist, Antonio Montez, what he thinks about free trade. He's worked in manufacturing, law enforcement, now private security. And like a lot of Americans, Montez is searching for that sweet spot when it comes to globalization.
Free trade has hurt us in an extent, but at the same time, free trade has helped us. But I think we need to look more and be protective of the U.S., because personally, I've been overseas, a veteran. We give a lot to other countries, and we're not getting nothing back in return.
Alexander Hamilton might have related. He wanted to put America first, too. But Hamilton also understood that protectionism comes at a cost, namely higher prices for consumers. In that big biography about Hamilton that was the basis for the musical, the author, Ron Chernow, writes that in Hamilton's vision for America, tariffs would be moderate, temporary, and repealed as soon as possible.
So you're thinking Hamilton the Musical 2.0, the trade and protectionist version?
Well, I'm not sure that would win a Tony Award, but I got to say, when I was digging into America's protectionist history, Scott, I did stumble onto actual songs about protectionism, believe it or not.
Okay, it was my understanding there would be no singing.
Well, I didn't promise that. Now, actually, this song is quite catchy. Don't make fun of it, Scott. It's a campaign song from 1896.
All right.
That's when Democrat William Jennings Bryan ran against Republican William McKinley. Now, he was a protectionist. And McKinley's supporters wrote a song about how great his policies were going to be. It's actually called McKinley Protection. I found the sheet music, and we got this amazing men's choir in Minneapolis, Cantus, to bring it to life. So take a listen to the seventh verse.
Our great manufactories are all standing still without McKinley protection. That's why all the gold is locked up in the till without McKinley protection. Just shut up our markets to the foreigners' mill and give us the laborers a chance at the till. And we'll bring back prosperity over the hill when we get McKinley protection.
So, Scott, did you catch that line? Just shut up our markets to the foreigner's mill and give us, the laborers, a chance at the till.
Ah, there it is. A chance at the till, a chance at the auto factory, a chance at the carrier plant in Indiana that was going to go to Mexico.
Right. It sounds so modern.
Yeah. Well, and I heard a similar slogan, that line about bringing prosperity back, right? So it's not too far from Make America Great Again. Same movie.
Definitely. And this was just the starting point.
So we've heard about Alexander Hamilton's fondness for tariffs, but that was by no means the only time the U.S. pushed protectionism.
Well, I have just two words for you, Scott. Smoot Hawley.
We've been saying those words a lot lately.
We have.
The names of the two politicians who pushed the infamous protectionist tariff bill.
Now, that was in 1930, and it's infamous because, or so the story goes, it tipped us into the Great Depression. Well, I'm sorry to break it to you, but that is not what happened. And it's worth taking time to understand what actually did happen, because protectionism often doesn't make great economic sense, but it can make sense politically. And Smoot Hawley is a perfect example of that. Even though, if you believe the movies, Smoot Hawley is the most boring chapter in American history.
The most boring ever.
In 1930, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, in an effort to alleviate the effects of the... Anyone? The Great Depression.
Ah, yes. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, circa 1986. That's the classroom scene.
Passed the... Anyone? The tariff bill, the Hawley-Smoot Tariff Act, which...
Ben Stein, comedian and real-life economist, placed the teacher while his students snooze, drool.
Bueller.
But it's actually a fascinating tragedy that leads to an economic train wreck.
Our protagonist and tragic hero is Reed Smoot, Republican senator from Utah, and the powerful chairman of the Senate Finance Committee.
See, Smoot was a Mormon and a very high-ranking leader of the Church of Latter-day Saints.
A devout gentleman, and as it turns out, a devout protectionist. Back then, the Mormon Church dominated the sugar beet industry out west. Mormon historian Matthew Godfrey has written all about it.
Wilford Woodruff, who was president and the prophet of the LDS Church when they got into the sugar business, said that he had had a revelation from God that the church needed to get into the sugar business.
So Mormon farmers grew beets, and the church controlled a huge sugar company, Utah-Idaho Sugar. In a little town that hugs the Wasatch Mountains called Spanish Fork, you can still see the remains of one of the company's sugar beet factories.
Now it's located right by I-15. You can hear the cars going by.
We approach a dark, abandoned space and peek inside. A century ago, this was where the sugar beets were sliced up and ground into a pulp before extracting the sugar.
So it looks to me like there's a chute up there that the beets would drop down into.
Senator Smoot wanted to protect Utah's beet sugar from the imported stuff, mostly cane sugar.
He used kind of very nativistic philosophies of the time, believing that white Americans were kind of the premier race at the time. And so he believed that if you could support an industry that included farmers who were white Americans, that that was more beneficial than relying on sugar that was grown by individuals from Cuba or areas outside of the United States.
Not only was that morally and economically dubious, it wasn't necessary. In the late 1920s, imported crops were not what really sank American farmers. Prices were low all over the world.
But the good protectionists didn't let that fact get in the way.
The Republican Party had to be seen as doing something to help farmers to win the farm vote in the Midwest.
That's Doug Irwin, Dartmouth economist, who wrote the book on Smoot-Hawley. It's called Peddling Protectionism. He says Congress initiates tariff hearings in 1929, at which point our nice little help the farmers package gets hijacked by city folks, a.k.a. Eastern manufacturers.
That's what brings out all the lobbyists and the industry groups saying this is an opportunity for us to sort of piggyback on the farm tariff by getting higher tariffs on ball bearings and steel and textiles and shoes and bricks.
And bottle caps and sprinkler tops.
And collapsible tubs and antimony, whatever that is.
Here's Irwin reading from a section in his book on kraut.
The National Kraut Packers Association called for an increase in the duty on kraut from 30% to 50%. A small farm in Maine requested a duty on canned sardines be raised from 30% to 50%. Someone from Ohio asked the tariff on imported goldfish to be increased to 35%.
The vital pet fish sector.
So how did this happen? Well, have you ever heard of congressional log rolling? Anyone? Anyone? Tong?
Kind of.
Okay. Say we chop down a tree together.
Mm-hmm.
I help you roll a bunch of logs to your house. You help roll some to mine. Or in this case, you support my tariff. I support yours.
Which helps all of us do one thing. Charge higher prices because of less competition. Well, the bill passes the House and it moves over to the Senate. And now we get to Smoot and Smut.
Wait a minute. Did you just say smut?
Yes, I did. Our Mormon protagonist also wants to ban the import of obscene materials.
He took a particular umbrage, for example, at D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover for having obscene passages in it.
You can Google them later.
And apparently he had a big stack of these books saying, you know, this is obscene material. We shouldn't be allowing this in the country. And people were pointing him saying, well, why are you have all these books? What are you doing reading them?
How'd you get them?
Yeah, exactly. How'd you get them?
Smoot smites smut is the famous headline of the day.
So the bill adds that, and it keeps moving. Nobody stops it.
Though a bunch of economists try, 1,028 of them, they write a letter to President Herbert Hoover warning it would lead to higher prices at home and retaliatory tariffs from America's trading partners.
But Congress disses them as blah, blah intellectuals. Take these two Republican senators, reenacted here.
I am not overawed by the proclamation of college professors who never earned a dollar by the sweat of their brow by honest labor.
Free trade intellectuals seem more concerned with the prosperity of foreigners than the well-being of our own American people.
Journalists oppose this, too. But somebody else's voice is entirely missing from this debate. Can you guess who that is? Anyone? Gardner?
I think it was consumers.
You got it. And pay attention here. This is the key to why protectionism is so often a political winner. Consumers who stand to pay a little bit more for sugar or sauerkraut tend not to protest. We'll call it the who cares effect.
Protectionism only sticks consumers with a nickel more here, a nickel more there. So who cares?
But producers, a few producers pocket all those nickels. They care. Here's Harvard political scientist Jeffrey Frieden.
The people who are benefiting or who stand to benefit from trade protection have a lot at stake. The people who are losing from trade protection have very little at stake.
And the example he gives today is the same example as 1929, sugar.
We in the U.S. pay two or three times as much as the world market price for sugar. First of all, very few Americans know that. And even the ones that do say, well, you know, okay, so I'm paying a couple of cents more for the sugar in my coffee every day. Who cares?
In the end, Smoot-Hawley raised taxes on nearly 20,000 imported goods. And even though it made bad economic sense, the bill made good political sense. And all the industries that successfully lobbied loved it. In June 1930, President Hoover signed Smoot-Hawley into law. And then something happens that those pesky economists predicted, a trade war.
By now, the Great Depression has begun, and our trading partners are plunging into their own recessions, so they strike back.
Yeah, no more Canadian nice. Our northern neighbors immediately slap tariffs on nearly a third of their American imports. Take eggs. U.S. egg sales to Canada fall 97%. And this happened to all kinds of American producers because Europe puts up trade walls, too.
Other countries begin to mimic the U.S., saying, well, if the U.S. is going to become isolationist, maybe we should do the same thing as well. So it sort of unleashes this dynamic, the falling dominoes.
So all this breeds ill will and a rising ultranationalism in Europe in the 1930s.
So what exactly was the damage from Smoot-Hawley's big adventure?
Anyone? Anyone know the effects?
Now, economists generally agree that the bill did not plunge us into depression. We were in the soup already. But it certainly didn't create jobs. And it probably deepened the depression since it shattered world trade. Everybody lost their global customers.
It also flipped the conversation about trade on its head. Up until the 1930s, protectionism was generally seen as a good, sort of patriotic thing.
Smoot-Hawley really just made protectionism a bad word. And it was associated with all sorts of things, declining exports, declining employment, Great Depression, ill will among foreign countries. It really did discredit protectionism as a doctrine in American political life.
The so-called golden rule of protectionism. Tariff unto others, as you would have others tariff unto you.
And you know, Scott, this wasn't just a legislative and economic tragedy. Senator Smoot had a downfall as well. Here's historian Brian Cannon at Brigham Young University.
Late in the legislative game, he was complaining to friends that he couldn't sleep at nights. He was taking sleeping pills and they weren't doing anything for him. He was just exhausted. And then when his opponents blamed the tariff for worsening the depression, he took that very personally, and voters in Utah turned him out. They probably would have anyway with the Democratic landslide in 1932. But he took that loss very personally, and he really just became a shell of his former self.
They don't tell you that part in high school, how protectionism can ruin a man's life. Okay, we're going to move now from the halls of Congress in 1930 to the halls of Van Nuys High School in 2017. Scott, Van Nuys is in LA's San Fernando Valley.
We sent our producer, Haley Hirschman, to talk with some students in the Advanced Placement World History class. These are young people who were born and raised when global connectedness was a given. Now, in AP classes, you have to take a test at the end, and you have to do well to get college credit. Well, this year's test included a part where students had to name examples of globalization and their effects. So we asked the students for their thoughts.
I think globalization is a good thing because it's a reason a lot of us exist. Immigration is a huge thing, and I wouldn't be here if my mom didn't immigrate to America. So,
from an economic perspective, I guess you could argue that it is bad because
when you have like other countries doing the jobs that could be done in the U.S., there's like a loss of jobs, and that's like a major problem.
It's something that's in your life every single day, and how it's something that's going to be continuing to happen, especially as new technologies do come into the world. And in this class, like, it just made us realize more like how it does affect us.
I think globalization is important to teach because these students are living in the 21st century. Their competition in the workforce and their career life is going to be with the whole world. They're not just competing with their fellow Americans anymore, and so they need an understanding of the world, and they need to be able to compete on a global level.
That was Kimberly, Delooney, Celeste, and their AP History teacher, Jim Neard. Hey, Sarah.
Yeah, Scott.
I want to ask you about helping people who are struggling with all this.
Okay.
Now, history has shown us that free trade and open borders, it often sends low-wage jobs to low-wage countries, right? The next cheaper place. So people lose jobs around the world when this happens, and politicians invariably promise to help them. Today, here, it's in America's Rust Belt. But what do we really owe the people who've lost out to free trade?
Well, before I answer that, let's play a clip from that TV show, The West Wing. Now, this was from 2004, and they're asking that very same question.
Do you ever wonder if we forget the human face of trade, that blood and muscle?
You have to go with what grows the economy for everyone. There's blood and muscle in India, too.
Yeah.
So, Scott, here's what I found in my reporting. Compensating the so-called losers, I'd rather call them casualties, actually, of globalization, it's complicated. There isn't really a passionate, powerful constituency to stand up for the people or the towns who stand to lose jobs to free trade. And this goes back to the early 1970s. I talked to economist Fred Bergsten. He's 76 years old now. I think you've interviewed him, Scott.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course. Fred Bergsten, founding director of the what's now the Peterson Institute of International Economics, with the big economic think tank just up the street from our office here, actually.
Right. But back then in the 70s, Bergsten chaired a Chamber of Commerce task force to figure out a better way to help American workers who had lost jobs in the free trade economy. At that time, imports from Japan were getting to be a concern. Now, there was a small program in place to help those people, but it was so narrow that in the first 6 years, not a single American worker qualified for the benefits, if you can believe it.
Wow.
So Bergsten writes up the task force findings, and he remembers taking this 20-page report to the Chamber of Commerce board.
So I entered their sanctum, their boardroom, took the podium. I presented our report. Very, very vigorous debate ensued.
And that's because Bergsten's report called for a lot more money for more workers, relocation assistance, even money for whole communities affected by plant closures. But while that plan was great for workers, it created problems for some industries in that chamber boardroom. If the government could really cushion the blow for, say, steel workers who lost jobs to foreign competition, that would make the loss of steel jobs less of a big deal, right? And it would weaken steel companies' argument for protectionist trade barriers.
Oh, I see. If you cushion the blow a little bit, then suddenly this industry doesn't have as much of an urgent emergency case to bring to Washington.
Exactly. And Bergsten says even some of the free trade advocates on the Chamber's board worried that a bigger federal program would just draw unwanted attention to the numbers of Americans losing jobs to trade.
To me, that was dramatic. And we've seen that more or less in the 40-plus years since, where politicians who support free trade are often unwilling to draw the logical inference that you have to take care of the downsides and the costs and the losers if you're going to sustain the free trade politically.
Now, I went to rural Wisconsin where there are or were all these paper mills. But in 10 years, that state lost a third of its paper mill jobs. That was from 2005 to 2015. And very few workers were ready for it. I met a former mill worker named Mark Van Stappen, who worked at a paper mill in northeastern Wisconsin for almost 30 years
I started at the bottom on some horrendously hardworking jobs where you threw logs all day into grinders, you know. But it was kind of cool. It was all right. It was sort of therapeutic. It was an okay type of deal.
Now, when Ben Stappen lost his job, globalization not only hit him, but it hit his wife, too.
My wife was working part-time when I worked at the mill. And immediately she says, I have to go work full-time. I have to. We no longer have stability in our lives, you know.
So Van Stappen's wife took a job at a company making envelopes. And he took a job, he told me, at a small green energy startup at a couple dollars an hour less. He said the health insurance was terrible and he had a longer commute. I also talked to Van Stappen's former coworker, Andy Nerschel. Now, Nerschel briefly thought about going back to school, you know, taking advantage of some retraining money to try for another career. But he told me, you know, it just wasn't for him.
I looked a little bit into training, but I didn't especially care for school when I was in high school, so I wasn't looking at going back again. I tried a couple different paper mill jobs that I thought, but I didn't get hired at any.
So, Scott, this is partly why the big retraining or reinvention promise is oversold. People don't or can't move to where the growth jobs are, or they're too old to retrain, or they can't afford to take the time off to go back to school, even with federal money. And the numbers bear this out. A 2014 survey of some laid-off mill workers in Wood County, Wisconsin, it showed that a little under 39% chose to participate in career retraining programs.
Yeah, you know, as you say that, Sarah, it just reminds me of talking to out-of-work coal miners in southern Illinois who say, you know, school is not for me. I work with my hands.
Yeah.
Now, policymakers and economists, they might assume workers will move or retrain, but it seems to me they're still trying to understand why so many people actually don't.
Earlier in the show, we talked about how protectionism played out in American history, and still does.
But the United States is not the only place with a history of tension between free trade and protectionism.
In fact, America can't lay claim to the intellectual ideas behind free trade. The case for why it's a good idea, as just about every economist today agrees with. It really started in northern England, in the city of Manchester, back in the 1800s.
And back then, to protect the farmers, the British government imposed tariffs against imported grain. They were called the Corn Laws. And the fascinating tale of how these laws got repealed is an Econ 101 prerequisite, with lessons for today.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard got that story for us, starting with a tour of Manchester.
On this busy street in the city centre stands Manchester's most beautiful building in glorious sandstone with Italianate arcades and richly decorated with carved figures. It's not quite what you'd expect to find in the world's first industrial city, a place once infamous for its smoke-belching chimneys. The building celebrates the birth here of a big idea and, says tour guide Elizabeth Sibbering, proclaims it with a bold inscription across the facade.
In big gold letters on the top, it says Free Trade Hall, and we think that's probably the only building in the whole world that's named after free trade. Usually it's named after monarchs or places or something like that. Manchester, Radical Manchester, Free Trade, so it's written on our city.
The hall, which today is a five-star hotel, was built in the mid-19th century to commemorate a victory. Victory for the Manchester men. They were the emerging class of merchants and manufacturers, and it was their fight in the 1840s against the British aristocracy that launched the movement against tariffs and trade barriers. Today, this vast Victorian cotton mill at Quarry Bank, south of the city, is a tourist attraction. Tens of thousands of visitors come here and are bemused by the clattering, wheezing Rube Goldberg machinery. But in the 1840s, says Mike Sanders of Manchester University, people marvelled at this scene. This was the future.
There is something awe-inspiring. There is something truly remarkable and amazing about the machinery, the precision, the way in which it produces cloth in quantities that previously could not have been dreamt of.
And produced undreamt of wealth. The new textile tycoons resented the old money and the power of the landed aristocracy, and they resented the steep tariffs that those aristocrats had fought to get. They'd made grain more expensive to bolster the profits of the crops grown on their land. Those corn laws, as these tariffs were called, also pushed up the price of bread, with devastating consequences for the poor.
We ask our daily bread.
This protest song from the 1840s says it all, lamenting the widespread starvation and angrily blaming the aristocracy.
Answer ye lordlings gay, ye useless idle few.
But why should the kings of cotton, who were hardly enlightened employers, be concerned about the high price of grain?
The merchantcy didn't like that because it meant that they had to keep wages high as well to keep their workers going in a way.
The cotton mill owners had a keen commercial interest in wanting to scrap the corn laws, says Elizabeth Sibbling.
They could see what problems it was causing for their workers. They couldn't afford to eat.
Workers and bosses, bankers and lawyers, politicians, churchmen and social reformers joined the crusade against the corn laws. It was a fight for cheaper food, a battle against the aristocracy, and for the textile tycoons in particular, a drive towards free trade. They wanted other countries to scrap their tariffs and throw open their markets to British goods. Like all good crusaders, says Mike Sanders, they convinced themselves that God was on their side.
It was the belief that the good Lord had made the world in such a way that the nations were supposed to trade, and anything that impeded free trade was harmful to the human race as a whole, and in their view, it was manifest in the form of people who were going hungry in one of the richest countries in the world.
The crusade crushed the aristocratic opposition. The Corn Laws were repealed in 1846. Foreign grain poured into Britain. Much of it came eventually from the former colony that supplied the Manchester mills with most of their raw cotton. Will Ashworth is author of a new book about the Industrial Revolution.
With the rapid influx of prairie grain from the USA, that impacted upon the social structure of Britain. You saw the demise of the landowner and the rise of the middling ranks and the owners of production due to the cheap imports now coming from the prairie lands of the United States of America to Britain.
The American Revolution, about 100 years after it had happened, finally humbled the British aristocracy, much to the satisfaction of the British manufacturing and commercial classes. But the repeal of the Corn Laws did not persuade the rest of the world to immediately follow suit, much to the chagrin of free traders.
My name is Adrian Wooldridge. I'm the political editor of The Economist. The Economist was founded in 1843 to pursue the case against the Corn Laws.
Yes, The Economist is part of this story. It was created to be the voice of the anti-Corn Law crusade. The irony, says Wooldridge, is that the foreign country that profited most from the repeal of those laws did not embark on the same program of tariff scrapping.
We think of America as being the sort of the great capitalist power. But in fact, America was a country that was opposed to free trade right the way through the 19th century and all the way up to 1945. Britain was the first country to embrace it and to say the best way to create universal prosperity is to have freedom of commerce and trade. And Britain led that in a world where that was disapproved of by almost everybody.
Britain may not have been high-minded in opposing the Corn Laws. The main aim may have been to exploit its industrial power, to flood other countries with its manufactured goods while they focus their energies on agriculture. If that was the plan, it has, in the long term, spectacularly backfired. Britain today has a large trade deficit. Its manufacturing is a pale shadow of its former self. Oh, and more than half of its food, including grain, comes from abroad. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Who knew? The Economist magazine started because of the corn laws. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, and you know, that story fits with this theme that we in the U.S. have no business blaming any other country for their trade policies. In that story from Stephen, you hear it. We were the ones flooding the world market with cheaper products back then and costing other countries jobs. And for our last story, you're going to give us a global perspective from Kansas City. Did I read that right, Scott?
That's right. You can actually tell a bunch of the India economic story from the Indian diaspora. And it turns out in Kansas City, there's a thriving South Asian community, a lot of Indians and Indian Americans whose lives helped to tell that story. So here in the rich countries, and we are the richest country in the world, we hear this angst of people who fear they're losing their economic edge, right? This fear that other countries are catching up. Economists actually use this term catch-up to describe emerging economies that are growing very quickly.
Yeah, there's even a sense that countries like China have overtaken us. Now, Scott, you've lived in China, and you've done a bunch of reporting on this. This idea of a global economic divergence a long time ago and now flipping to convergence, is the gap really narrowing?
Well, for many countries, it is. If we go back to the 1800s, right, the Industrial Revolution, steam engines, steamships, railroads, the telegraph, that all benefited a small percentage of people in the world, maybe only 15% of the people in Western Europe and North America, plus Australia and New Zealand. I mean, their economies grew steadily, but everybody else in the rest of the world kind of stood still economically. So you have this, as you said, this divergence, this separation. But now the new globalization, container ships, the internet, global supply chains, has allowed many countries that recently opened up to the world to start making up that gap. It's convergence. Now, the gap is huge, and there's still a long way to go before incomes there even start to approach the incomes here.
So tell us about India by way of Kansas City, Scott.
One way to understand how fast the Indian economy is running is to join Indian men who are running. On a cricket pitch in Kansas City. Really, this is a technology city, home to companies like Sprint and Garmin. And these software and IT professionals spend their Saturdays batting and pitching. I mean, bowling. League president Suresh Kannan bats righty, works for Sprint.
When I came here back in 97, there was only maybe a couple of teams. Not great players. You got to go call players and beg them to come to play, you know. Since then, total number of players are around 600.
The Indian community here, now 7,000 strong, has boomed as the economy back home has exploded. It's a global story of Indian talent connecting with U.S. education and technology and investment. India's economy is now growing at 7% a year. It's the fastest growing large country in the world. And this is a story of what economists call catch-up, where poor countries adopt proven technology and ideas by opening up to the outside world. But for all the whooping, there's now tension as the Indians here question how open the U.S. is to them. In February, at a bar in the suburb of Olathe, a white man shot two Indian men, IT workers, cricket teammates, and killed one. The shooter first asked about the men's immigration status. Aviva Ajmera is an Indian American who works as a business strategy consultant in Kansas City.
Even if you're born and raised here, when something like the shooting in Olathe happens in your community, everybody feels vulnerable because we look different.
Now she looks over her shoulder more often, watches other people watching her, even though the city rallied for its immigrants right after the shooting.
The Kansas City community, not just the Indian community, came together just to show support for the Indian community. I mean, kind of the message was, yeah, that happened and it was awful, but that's not our city.
The concern is not just the shooting. People of Indian descent have heard President Trump talk about limiting trade deals and visas. And they heard ex-White House strategist Steve Bannon blast South Asians in a Breitbart talk radio show.
You know, when 3/4 of the CEOs in Silicon Valley are from South Asia or from Asia, I think my point is that a country's more than an economy. We're a civic society.
The resentment could have something to do with who's catching up. For 3 decades now, fast-growing economies like India and China have narrowed the gap with the rich world, while working-class incomes in the U.S. have stayed flat. Economist Branko Milanovic at the City University in New York says one does not cause the other, but some might think it does.
That was seen as one indication of why there was disenchantment with globalization or why maybe these people voted in favor of Brexit or Trump.
In Kansas City, fewer college applications from India are landing, and fewer Indians are being hired by companies nervous that the visa rules could change. Now, there's no wholesale exodus, but things have changed since the earliest IT workers came in the early 90s. Back then, India was just emerging from a Soviet-style, centrally planned economy. As in one TV channel, says Suresh Kannan of the Cricket League.
If you have a TV, you are a rich person. We basically forced our parents to buy a TV, and we bought a color TV, and we were like popular family around the neighborhood. They used to call us a color TV family.
Then in 1991, India's government opened up the country dramatically. And in came American companies, investors, lowbrow TV shows.
Like you.
The popular shows was a Jerry Springer show.
Jerry Springer.
Yeah. We used to think it's all real.
People throwing chairs at each other.
Yeah, all those things. And, yeah. And then watching Baywatch was a shock for us because that's something completely against our Indian culture at that time.
Great moments in globalization. Kansas City IT entrepreneur Manoj Manethumaril says when he was a kid in India, there was one model of car on the road. The Hindustan Motors Ambassador was so noisy that kids playing on the street could safely hear it blocks away. And then came the affordable, fuel-efficient Suzuki car. Its only problem? Too quiet.
We used to tell people, be careful, those cars doesn't make any sounds.
Manethumaril graduated college and then studied programming in India. And that's a key ingredient to the country's catch-up recipe, which includes education, democracy, openness, investment, entrepreneurs. He was hired in the Bangalore office of the Digital Equipment Corporation, based in faraway Massachusetts. At the time, U.S. tech firms were recruiting heavily in India.
And I think the primary motivation was that year 2000 computer problem, Y2K problem. They were going to rewrite the code, so they need huge manpower.
Eventually, he got hired by a firm in Silicon Valley, and then he moved to Kansas City to form his own company. Why there? Nice people, cheaper housing.
Only thing we didn't like was the winter, the cold.
And there are other disconnects. Many Indians are vegetarians in the land of Kansas City barbecue, trying to grasp American jokes.
So when I sit in meetings, somebody crack a joke, and I will have to synchronize my laugh with them. And then later ask, what did it mean?
Like all business owners, Manethumaril competes on price. And often, the best bang for his buck is to outsource the simpler IT work back to India. And that revenue back home is helping to fuel a rising consumer economy. The average income in India is rising 3 times faster than it is here. Economist Branko Milanovic.
We are really talking here about a rebalancing of the world and significantly higher incomes in Asia. And I think openness and globalization played a very important role in that.
The upshot? Today, there's a thicker global economic middle.
It is a very favorable, very good development. And it led to what I called actually the largest reshuffle of incomes since the Industrial Revolution.
And some believe that despite the recent backlash, the U.S. will remain connected to the India growth story. Ramanan Lakshminarayan is an economist and epidemiologist who lectures at Princeton. He says both countries are connected by language, democracy, technology, and worldview.
These are places that will be connected in mind, certainly not by geography, but certainly in mind space, which is the most important space. I don't think an H-1B problem of today or one crazy guy in Kansas is going to change that story.
A U.S. citizen, Lakshminarayan now lives in India, where he started a company called Health Cubed. Its device brings diagnostic tests, cholesterol, pregnancy, HIV, malaria, to the village masses. And India's health market is the next big thing.
As you grow wealthier, you actually want the health in order to be able to enjoy that wealth. There's no point dying off at the age of 30, you know, after you've made a lot of money.
For India's catch-up, there's still a long way to run. The average income per person there is about $2,000 compared to about $57,000 here.
Good running, good running.
And at the center of this is cricketers in places like Kansas City, global middlemen in a global game. Right now, laughing at an American reporter trying to play theirs.
And that's the last word in this Marketplace special, Trade-Off, stories of globalization, backlash, how we got here, and what may lie ahead. Even though this hour is wrapping up, the conflicts we talked about continue as the U.S. wrestles with how to engage the world and how the world wants to engage with us.
You'll be hearing a lot more on the air and on our Marketplace podcasts. Meantime, head over to marketplace.org to see our past coverage, plus a video about the winners and losers of globalization that may surprise you.
And that would be starring Scott Tong. Nice job, Scott.
And starring a lot of graphics and video covering up Scott Tong.
This trade-off special is produced by Haley Hirschman.
Our editor is Eve Tro, and Charlton Thorpe is our engineer.
Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer.
Deborah Clark is our vice president and general manager.
I'm Sarah Gardner.
And I'm Scott Tong. Thanks for listening. This is APM.